Welcome to On the Brink Radio, show number 118. This is Jeff Wefferson here in Harvey Bay, Queensland. It's Thursday, August 6th, I believe, 2015. I'm looking out across the bay itself at the northern half of Fraser Island, an island very close to shore, about 100 kilometers long. They say it's the largest totally sand island in the world. The whole northern half of the island is now covered with smoke. About 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 major plumes of smoke rising in sort of a horizontally distributed mass of smoke now appears to cover half of the whole island, as far as I can see. Very interesting that these fires have just been set this morning by what used to be called the Department of Environment and Conservation. I forget what they're called now. But it's very interesting. I was guided. I almost went there this morning for at least a few hours, or possibly for an overnight camping trip, but I was guided not to go, apparently because my guardians, angels, knew that this was going to happen. Who would want to be there now when the place is just billowing with smoke? I mean, the smoke plume I'm looking at now almost looks like a nuclear explosion. Very interesting synchronicity that if today is the 6th of August, as I believe, today is the anniversary of the first atomic bomb detonation on a human population at Hiroshima in Japan in 1945. August 8th would be the anniversary of Nagasaki. I might have these days wrong by a day. It might be the 6th and the 9th. The purpose of today's show is to talk about the whale watching industry from the perspective of someone who has been involved with the whales and dolphins ever since around 1980. Or earlier, when I first really became interested in and heard their call. This visit to Australia since March has been profoundly enlightening to me with respect to my ongoing research and Beyond Film project about the whales and dolphins. It's called Aihi Tohora Pakia Wananga, The Knowledge and Wisdom of Whales and Dolphins. It's going to be a series of films because of the breadth and depth of the subject matter, no less than the true story of who we are as people on the land, who the people of the sea are, what it actually means to be a person. You don't have to be a human being to be a person. Beginning with the last few months I was in Australia last year, when I really connected with the whale dreaming people in the Gosford area, Gabby Duncan, the Dark and John Gummeroy whale dreaming story person. Very, very, very powerful connection that I felt had been 15 years in the making. Being central to a multi-dimensional and autobiographical concept that I've been talking about in recent radio shows called the Karingi Lawler Lily Narby Vilikovsky hypothesis. It's been very interesting how Australia, the Dreamtime ancestors, the rainbow serpent, the whales and dolphins themselves, the consciousness of the indigenous people here has been guiding me. In my first few months back in Australia, I was sort of adopted by the Gosford area, many thanks to my friends Robert Hogenbaum and Michael Spratt there, which is true, true whale-dreaming country in terms of the energy of the land, the rock art, the presence that I feel there, like at the Bulgandri Biami Dreaming Site, Booty National Park, the Wamburul Lagoon, where I had a beautiful double encounter with the octopus there. Very, very, very powerful area. Then, after I returned to Tasmania, I went up and visited my wonderful friends Adam and Emma Godwin and their kids, Jake and Deesa, who I would really like to thank for their extreme hospitality and magnanimity for the few weeks I stayed with them. got adopted by that area in Hawk's Nest, New South Wales. Camped out at a place called Little Gibba. Did a radio show from there a couple of weeks ago about the heliacal rising of Sirius, which relates to all this too. Went to Yakaba and Tomaree, two sacred ancient volcanic peaks. Became friends with whale-watching entrepreneur Frank Future and his lovely partner Shakti. I'd like to thank them for all their support. So, between Gosford and the Nelson Bay Hawks Nest Tea Garden area, I spent probably more than 3 months in those two areas, really connecting with the land and the whale dreaming, being by the ocean all the time. Very, very, very awesome. So that was several months of exploring the whale dreaming aspect of my ongoing research and endeavor to understand and be an advocate for Kaitiaki on behalf of the whales and dolphins, who I consider to be not only the ultimate indigenous people, but a true extraterrestrial intelligence. Well, beginning in Nelson Bay with Frank Future, I started really getting an inside look at the whale watching industry in Australia, which might be one of the earliest ones in the world. I'm not really sure. I haven't really looked at it. But I think Frank built his boat called Imagine in around 1990. He was nice enough to take me out 4 times on his boat. As anyone who knows me knows, I'm not a fan of motorized whale watching at all. My basic feeling is that people should stay out of the ocean. And if you've got to go in the ocean, do it on a kayak or a surfboard or swimming or a sailboat that uses the sails, not ones that use hydrocarbon burning engines all the time. I always ask the people that run the whale watching tours, I go like, well, would you want groups of people or other beings coming around you, wherever you were, maybe at your house, coming in your house or in your yard, looking at you, taking pictures of you, recording you, yelling at you, imitating you, studying you, sending drones over you. How would you feel? And I'm saying this to anybody out there. How would you feel if this happened to you? So this is another reason behind why people find it hard to express exactly why they love the whales and dolphins so much. I interviewed Frank Future 2 different times there in Nelson Bay. I didn't ask him any of the really hard or pointed questions that I have always wanted to ask people who run whale watching businesses. But when I met Brian Perry here in Harvey Bay yesterday, he's supposedly the founder of the first whale watching enterprise in Australia in 1987 here in Harvey Bay, as a town stroke city that bills itself as the quote unquote whale watching capital of the world, unquote. He made it clear that they founded the first whale watching business in 1987. He was kind enough to, even though he never heard of me before, introduce myself, and he gave me about 10 minutes of time where I interviewed him, and I did ask him the hard pointed questions, and he answered me, I think truthfully, more or less, questions about, for example, fuel consumption in hydrocarbon powered whale watching boats, which I'll share that information with you later. As an aside to all this, just as I was sitting here, I'm at a picnic table at the beach at Harvey Bay, down near the Esplanade, looking out over Fraser Island and the smoke plumes. A man and a woman came walking by with a white sulfur crested cockatoo on this man's shoulder. And when they came back by, I stopped and talked to him and met the cockatoo. His name's Callahan. There's nothing wrong with him, and he's about 9 months old. So what they had him on a leash, kind of like a leash for a dog, but it had a stretchable elastic section too that's a flight leash. So he can actually fly a short distance, flap his wings and stuff. And it's really cool to make the acquaintance of another cockatoo in person, so to speak. Like, I met with this one called Cocky down in Sheffield, Tasmania last year, who was in a cage. He had had a broken wing since he was 9 months old, the same age as this one, and he was now apparently 30 years old. But I had a painted rock that I'd painted a white cockatoo on, and got a really cool picture of me in the cage holding my rock next to Cocky. And so the couple today, Carrie and Robert, let me take a picture of Callahan with my painted rock, and then he let me pet him a couple of times. That was quite cool. They couldn't get him to talk. I won't say that I'm not sure how I feel about having a perfectly healthy bird on a leash, because I do know how I feel. I don't think it's a good idea. I think it's more human vanity and arrogance, thinking we have the right to take the freedom of another being. And of course, these people would justify it and rationalize it by saying, oh, but look, he's perfectly happy now. Which may in fact be the case. But he's not a free cockatoo, which is really how they're meant to be. They've taken a significant part of his life, and even though he might be happy, is happiness the ultimate goal of life? In the same way, the people that run these whale watching businesses are the first to tell you that, well, look, the whales, they don't run away from us. They come right up to the boat and hang out there. Like, and the whales actually did that today to a certain degree. The boat, of course, sped under full power at probably its top cruising speed of about 20 knots to get to where the whale blows were. But then once it was there, it slowed down and approached to the maximum approach distance allowed by law, which is 100 meters. Then a couple of times the whales did approach closer to the boat, come over, hung out for quite a while. This was my longest, most extended encounter with humpback whales. They were probably, for quite a while, only, you know, probably 10 meters from where I was. And I did feel a very powerful, interesting connection with them. It was really weird, though. Some of the people, this one woman in particular, kept yelling at the humpback whales and talking to them as if they were dogs, in that exact voice, like, here, here, good whale, come here. And, you know, and just like, and she wouldn't shut up. So that was a really interesting and kind of bizarre behavior in itself. The people were clapping, applauding. I just think it would be so much more powerful that if you were in a situation like that, to be in a state of complete silence and listening, silencing your own inner vibrations so that you might have a better chance of experiencing who the whales actually are as fellow beings. But that's far beyond the capability of almost everybody today. So why is industrial whale watching tourism not good? I think that, first of all, express the good side of it, because I think that it does create an opportunity for people to see and be near whales. And the fact that they're interested in doing that is good. It shows that they're interested in something that's alive, regardless of what their actual beliefs and attitudes are. On the boat today, for the first time, it's not like I hardly ever go on whale watching boats. I'm not a supporter of the industry, but this was the fifth one I've gone on in the past few weeks. And on today, for the first time, I actually started talking to some of the people there about what inspired them to go on a whale watching tour, and if they had done it before, and who or what the whales represented to them in their mind. And the people pretty much said, almost word for word, exactly what I was expecting them to say, that one of the men said, like, oh, they're just such magnificent animals. I've heard that expression so many times, magnificent animals. And the woman goes, oh, well, I just love them, but they can never really tell me why. And she goes, well, but they're mammals, aren't they? And I'm like, yes, they are. And so, but that's about as far as it goes. So I think that the whale watching industry does serve the purpose of getting people out to where the whales are so that they can see them and be close to them. Beautiful magpie singing right above me in the tree. Kingdom of the birds. But when it comes to being open to who they really are, who they really might be, very few people are willing and or able to go down that road very far. Because, as I've really come to understand very deeply, the limitations lie within us. Most of our whole conscious life is bounded and filtered by the contents of our own mind, the constructs of our own language, of our own shared consensus reality that increasingly consists only of artifacts of human creation. Now there's a little teeny spider going across my microphone. I would say that any serious attempt to truly understand who the whales and dolphins are as fellow beings, or other kingdoms of life too, the trees, the birds, the star nations, the crystals and minerals, any serious attempt to truly understand the non-human kingdoms requires an utmost endeavor rooted in an understanding of your own psychology to the extent that it should be called shamanic or neo-shamanic, in the sense of what's required of yourself, your own self-mastery. You have to understand and master yourself before you can go beyond that which is just you. Again, this is a very arduous and time-consuming, difficult path that most people don't have time for. So whale watching does get people out in the boats, puts them near the whales. That's the good part. So this is all at the expense of many things. A, people are charged a lot of money to do this. And I'd be willing to bet that there is no whale watch operator in the world who ever decided to create a whale watching business that was free. They started out as entrepreneurs looking for a new way to make money off of people, off of tourism. And it's not just a little bit of money, it's a lot. And when you think of all they have to do, it's kind of like, it's quite similar to people that open a caravan park. All you have to do is have a piece of land, build some minimal facilities on there, divide it up into little areas, and set up an office, get a few permits and stuff. Then you can charge people basically however much you can extort from them for the privilege of setting up their tent or their caravan on your piece of land. It's a racket. And the whale watching industry is only one step behind, in the sense that in whale watching, you don't rent out a piece of land. You rent out a square meter of space on your boat. So the operating expenses for the boat are significantly more. I got some hard data today from Brian Perry's boat called the Quick Cat 2, that has twin 430 horsepower Cummins diesel engines. The driver today told me that they consume about 70 liters per hour. Yesterday, in his interview, Brian said that they consume about 1,000 liters of diesel fuel per day. So that's for the one boat making two trips a day. So I'm not sure how many days of the year they operate. But if they operated 365 days a year, that would be 365,000 liters of diesel fuel. And diesel's about $1 a liter, plus or minus. So we'll say $400,000 in diesel fuel. And if you're a believer in the climate change hysteria and the whole thing with carbon dioxide being a demon, an environmental demon that must be eradicated, then how much carbon dioxide is generated from the combustion of 365,000 liters of diesel by one boat? According to Brian, there's 8 whale watching operators in Harvey Bay. According to Frank Future in Nelson Bay, another top whale watching area, there's 3 operators there. Frank never provided any statistics on fuel consumption, but he did say that the whale watching brings $40 million a year into Nelson Bay alone. So with 8 tourism operators here in Harvey Bay, the whale watching capital of the world, it might be closer to $200 or $300 million a year. Because the way they figure is, it's not just the money that they pay to the whale watching operator, it's the money that the people also pay when they come to stay there. Coming to go and see the whales could be the big attraction that draws people here from international destinations. When they come, of course, they're going to spend probably thousands of dollars for the minimum short stay in accommodation, food, vehicle rentals, buying this and that, everything. So this is how they all figured into the equation. Now, this takes us to what I can consider to be a very dangerous development here in Queensland over the past few months. Somehow, they've been granted a permit by whoever it is that grants these permits. That's what I'm on the trail of tracking down now. A permit to allow people to go in the water and swim with the humpback whales. And according to Brian Perry, yesterday, he told me that it was in fact him, his company, that has been granted this singular permit to allow people to swim with humpback whales. So I asked him about exactly what that meant, and he explained 3 different ways in which people would swim with the whales. Now, as I understand it, my immediate question to him was, well, how close would you then be allowed to go to them in your boat? And I think he said that the 100-meter limit still applies, and so they would position themselves there, and then if the whales wanted to approach, then that's up to the whales. But the people wouldn't just be dumped into the water in wetsuits like they are in Kaikoura, New Zealand, for dolphin swims. They would be either attached with a rope or inside some kind of net or cage or something like that, I'm guessing to protect them from sharks inside the cage. That was Frank Future's immediate admonition against whale watching in the Sunshine Coast area here, was because of, he said, it's quite sharky there around Mooloolaba. So, the article on this new swimming with humpback whales permit was basically, I'll have to go back to the article and find out who it was they interviewed. It might have even been Brian Perry himself, but ultimately all they were talking about, they weren't even talking about how this might create an opportunity for people to get to know the whales better, you know, experience their vibe, their energy up close, look into their eyes, maybe even touch them if they came close enough. They didn't even say any of this stuff. All they talked about was reeling off statistics about how many new hotel beds that this might be worth per year, and how they were going to, they've already had pre-bookings from international clients in Europe and the British Isles and stuff to come here and swim with humpback whales. So beyond whale watching, which has now become old school, passé, everybody's been there, done that. Now, for an area like Harvey Bay, the self-acclaimed whale watching capital of the world, for them to be able to advertise in National Geographic, for example, right alongside your advert from New Zealand, 100% clean and green, New Zealand, where they use 85% of all the 1080 poison deployed in the world, and where the Maui's dolphin is on the very brink of extinction there on the North Island in New Zealand, 100% clean and green. Now, Australia, Harvey Bay can advertise that here in the whale watching capital of the world, and no, they're not paying me to say that. You can now come and swim with humpback whales. So imagine what kind of tourism draw that's going to be. People are going to be flying in from every continent on the planet so that they can come here and book their tour to swim with humpback whales. I find it disgusting, to say the least. Brian Perry seemed like a pretty cool dude for a capitalist, which he is. I was talking with him about finding more underwater footage to use in my film project. And yesterday he said that they had heaps, but then today he goes like, "Oh, well, we sold it all off." That was my drum cracking from the sun. "We sold all our footage, but we want to get more. I want to get," this is Brian talking, "he wants to get underwater footage of people with whales." And my immediate response was, in my mind, I went like, well, you know, the only footage I'm interested in is footage that doesn't have people or boats or anything. But my immediate response to him was, I went like, well, I think people swimming with the humpback whales is a really bad idea. And at first, for the first few seconds, he actually seemed like he actually cared about why I said that. He goes like, why? As if he had never even thought that there could be anything negative about it. And I didn't even try to go into it. I just went like, well, he goes, why do you think that? I go like, well, it's a very sensitive and educated opinion. Who knows if I'll have a chance to talk with him more. Because when you say stuff like that, people turn off. I think we should stay out of the ocean. We should get out of the ocean. If people want to do whale watching, they should go out in a sailboat or a kayak or a canoe or a surfboard or just swimming. Anything that doesn't use motors. Because ironically, even though Frank Future's boat called the Imagine is a beautifully crafted large 55-foot catamaran with a giant sail, it never gets used. Ever. I didn't ask Frank for statistics on how many hours or days of the year that the Imagine is actually under sail. But I would guess that almost never, because you can't go in and out really fast and chase the whales with the sailboat. And they do chase the whales. I guarantee you that if we were to have to compare video footage of whaling boats pursuing whales with big harpoon guns mounted on the front of the boat, that they would be deploying themselves in precisely the same manner as these whale watching boats that are zooming out under full speed to try to catch up with. As soon as they see a whale blow, they zoom over that way. It's exactly what whalers do. It's the exact same thing. This is non-lethal exploitation. I'll repeat that. Non-lethal exploitation. And there may be an element of oxymoron in there, because ultimately a lot of this could be lethal. There's a very interesting statement made by this young couple from Western Australia. I can't remember their first names, but their last name is Jenner, J-E-N-N-E-R. They conduct humpback whale research off the coast of Shark Bay, Denham, Exmouth, around in there, the central west coast of the southern Pilbara region, Western Australia. In their documentary called Whale Song, from, I think it's from the year 2007, they expressly state in no uncertain terms that in Western Australia, the greatest threat to whales is from whale-watching boats. I'll repeat. In Western Australia, the greatest threat to whales is from whale-watching boats. I can totally understand why. There's many different reasons. Few of the tourism operators want to consider or admit the contribution of their boats to the acoustic pollution, the increase in anthropogenic noise levels in the local marine environment. It's very, very, very significant. I need to do a little research to figure out what we know, and I'm sure the Office of Naval Research will be glad to supply me with this information, because surely they have it. But if you think about a sound source underwater, say like an explosion, or even a smaller sound, like the strike of a hammer, something sharp, how rapidly and intensely that shockwave from that sound is going to travel in water. We all know from basic physics that sound travels faster and more intensely in water because it's more of a dense medium than air. But like with other forms of mechanical propagation, the intensity of the sound level drops off exponentially as you get further and further in time and distance from the initial sound source. So what we have to do is compute the asymptotic level at which the sound pressure level drops off to zero. That would give us the maximum distance within which the sound could be heard. Then we also need to correlate that with what's known about the sensitivity threshold hearing levels for different cetaceans. That is, what the minimum level of sound is that they can hear. If we were able to work with this information, we could compute a sort of a more accurate model of the saturation of the marine environment with anthropogenic noise based on statistical estimates of different sound sources, both mobile and stationary, from mechanical, electromagnetic, all the different sort of sound sources. And then it would give us sort of a density of the saturation of sound. An article I read a few years ago said that, and this is probably from 5 years ago, that the overall noise level in the ocean has increased by over 12 decibels. And I just saw an article the other day about how dolphins have to, quote-unquote, shout in order to make themselves heard to their fellow beings. I mean, all this is like just pure common sense and logic. But it's a result of the summation of human activity in the ocean. It's if you take any single source, any single boat, any single operator, any single industry, they're not insignificant in themselves, but it's not the whole problem. So, but people tend to look, when people want to consider a problem like this, they tend to just look at them. They go like, well, look, my boat or my boats are only operating this amount of hours a day and generating this much noise, you know. So it's a very tiny contribution to the whole. But everybody's contribution is what the total net effect consists of. That's where my work comes in. I'm trying to take a global perspective on all these real threats to the whales and dolphins, like that really loud motorboat that we can hear right there now. I recorded the sound level on the boat today, the Quickette 2 owned by Brian Perry out of Harvey Bay, after he told me yesterday that his boat had actually been certified and won awards for its eco-tourism rating of how fuel-efficient and noise-efficient, how quiet it was. Yet, when I was standing on the deck of this boat, my whole body was jarring from the vibration, and the sound level was, I would say, it was probably easily 70 dB. Easily. 80 dB of constant exposure is a level at which hearing damage occurs in people. This is in air, standing on top of the boat. If I was able to record the sound under the water, outside the boat as it was moving, and that could be done with their hydrophones. In fact, I should get some people to do that sometime, to record their own underwater noise with their own hydrophones. That would tell us exactly a much more accurate picture of what the whales experience. Another thing is the whales and dolphins getting sliced with propellers. That's where Frank Future was a step ahead. I learned from a guy named Michel André, who's a whale and dolphin safety researcher. I believe he's French or Canadian. Of these things called shrouds. It's sort of a protective cover that goes around the propeller that would physically prevent the blades of the propeller from touching anything that came around, like a dolphin or a whale, a fluke, a flipper, a turtle. You know, like maybe small fish could get up in there. So Frank has that on his boats. But Brian Perry, I asked him yesterday if he knew what a shroud was, and he said yes. And I go, like, well, do you have them on your boats? And he goes, no. And I go, like, well, why not? And he goes, like, his first response was, well, it inhibits the performance of the boat. That was his first concern. It had nothing to do with the safety or well-being of the whales and dolphins. It was the shroud inhibits the performance of the boat. That is, their speed and maneuverability. So, as you can see, when I interviewed Frank Future, he actually said, and I've got this on tape, and I don't think he meant to say it, I think it was a Freudian slip, he said that whale watching is the greatest threat to whales. I think what he actually meant to say was that whaling is the greatest threat to whales, which we all know it isn't, but I think he slipped up and admitted something that he actually thinks has elements of truth, but would never say on purpose. Even though the Jenners said it in Western Australia several years ago. It's clear beyond a shadow of a doubt that anybody that's a whale watch tourism operator is in it for the money. Because if you just think of how much money they can make, I mean, at least someone with higher integrity like Frank has a guarantee that if you don't see whales, they give you your money back. So that's why he tries to make sure every day before they go that they're going to see some whales, because he wants to collect several thousand dollars from people, spend a bunch of money on fuel and time paying your employees, and then have to bring them all back and give all that money back. That's not what tourism operators like to do. So this guy today, Brian Perry, I never saw any sort of guarantee like that. But I do have to tell you about the guy that I met yesterday. I think his name is Lloyd something. He owns Tasman Ventures Whale Watching. This was your classic whale watching capitalist that clearly had no interest in the whales at all, other than as a source of income. And he had a giant multi-level boat with at least three or four decks, full of people, probably, I would say, 100 to 150 people, each of which were paying right at $100 a piece to be on there. So that's probably between $10,000 and $15,000 for one boat ride, lasting probably a maximum of 4 or 5 hours. So even though I explained It's not that I'm anybody, so that who I am would mean anything except to people that know me, but I'd been referred to try to catch up with a woman who works for him named Vicky Nettle, who does photography and stuff, but she's really just the tourism component there, by my friend Wally Franklin down in Byron Bay. So I tried to make a deal with them where I would give them some hand-painted rocks in exchange for going out on this boat that was already full. But the guy was going to make between $10,000 and $15,000 on this one ride, and he wouldn't even accept some painted rocks for me to let me go along, even though I'd been referred by Wally Franklin, who I consider to be one of the top whale and dolphin researchers and advocates in the whole world. So that really turned me off, but it was only because of that I met Brian Perry yesterday. But that tells you what it's all about. I saw many of these big boats down in Nelson Bay. It kind of sickened me. These boats they're huge, sort of like small apartment buildings, the ones operated by the council there in Nelson Bay. I can't remember what the boats are actually called, but they've got fully blown buffet restaurants, maybe like sort of casino-like things or nightclubs on there. They play really loud, stupid music. The sound of the people talking, the music is broadcast over these loudspeakers. This is even before the boat even left the harbor. This is your typical whale-watching experience. People are going out there with their screaming kids, and hooing and hawing and carrying on and getting drunk and stuffing their faces with all this food. And the whale, when they finally get to where the whales are, they look at them for a few minutes and clap and take their pictures with the GoPro on the selfie stick. And then they're back to their ice cream and wiping the kids' noses and talking about where they're going next on their holiday. So this is what it's all about. That is the nature of industrial whale watching. I'd really like to thank Frank Future, who I consider to be a very dear friend, and Brian Perry, who I won't call him a friend, but he was a nice enough guy to give me some time and let me go out on their whale watching boat today, for the opportunity for me to gain some really interesting insight and firsthand experience and information about whale watching. To me, it was, of course, it's nice to go out there and be close to the whales. It was quite special, especially the second day when I went with Frank and we were sort of moving alongside the whales, and I really felt the urgency of their movement along their navigational song line. The whales today didn't seem to be in motion as much. They were kind of, Wally says that the whales here in Harvey Bay this time of year are sort of taking a break from their migratory pattern. So it's a very special, rare opportunity and privilege for me to be physically near the whales and dolphins. But it's not necessary. It's not essential for what I do. I don't have to go in the water to be in touch with them, to love them, to work and be inspired on their behalf, to try to create a voice within my sphere of influence in the human media and noosphere, to get the reality of who they are and what the real global threats to them are onto the public radar. That's my primary goal. Beyond that are the more cosmic esoteric dimensions, the knowledge and wisdom that I believe that they have. This relates with the Kuringi, Lawler, Lilly, Narby, Velikovsky hypothesis and the water-based life, possibly the Sirius star system, this whole sort of complex of ideas that I've talked about in recent shows, the connection with the indigenous people of Australia, the whale-dreaming people, the ancient song line concerning the whales and dolphins that runs from eastern Australia over to Uluru and beyond. This is all, to me, extremely not just interesting in a superfluous or academic way, but it's an essential core of reality to be pursuing, because it relates ultimately to who we are on Mother Earth. and who else is here, and understanding ourselves from the perspective of beings who are people but aren't human. So this is why I always come back to you trying to put myself in the place of the whales. I ask other people to do the same, these tourism operators, the researchers. Everybody's got their own agenda. And I would say, almost without exception, I'm the only person I know doing what anybody could consider to be serious research and work and advocacy on behalf of the whales and dolphins who is not making money from it. I'm not a nonprofit organization. I don't work for a company, an NGO. I don't work for the government. I don't work for the United Nations. I don't work for Greenpeace or Sea Shepherd or IFAW or anybody. And because I'm totally independent, self-funded, I'm able to be aware of, entertain, share, express, and convey an ever greater approximation of the total truth and reality of what's happening with the whales and dolphins. I'm sitting here looking out at the bushfires on Fraser Island. It's just astronomical now. I would say that two-thirds of the length of Fraser Island is covered by smoke, both plumes and horizontal drift. So I'm so glad I didn't go out there today. But that's just an element of the insanity in the human relationship with nature. I'm sitting on a beautiful beach, looking at smoke plumes from fires set by people. The couple comes along with the perfectly healthy young white cockatoo on a flight leash. These are just a few examples. I came from a whale watching boat today where hundreds of liters of fuel were burned as part of an ecotourism adventure where the boat was raised at over 20 knots to zoom over and get close to these whales. And again, I've said this before, just because they don't flee doesn't mean that they aren't annoyed, or we have no way of knowing or sensing what their feelings and emotions are. An interesting thing did happen on the boat today. I got a still photo of it. My video camera wasn't in operation at the time. It was a very, very, very massive tail slap right in front of the boat where all the people were standing there. It's probably only 15 meters away. The whale slapped his tail from out of the water, 2 or 3 meters out of the water, down really hard. It made a really, really, really loud sound and splashed a bunch of water. To me, my instant impression was that this action on the part of the whale signified that it was pissed off. It was signaling a threat or telling us that it was not happy with what we were doing or had just done. And it reminded me very much not to cross compare the behavior of mammals and reptiles, but we were on a boat in Kakadu a few years ago doing an extraordinarily rare trip on yellow waters, and we were really angered by the driver who was chasing these crocodiles relentlessly, just chasing them, getting way too close. And finally, one of them turned around and snapped its jaw so loud it sounded like a peal of thunder almost, and then it slapped its tail. So I think doing things like that, I think, are these beings' way of expressing unhappiness with what the humans are doing. But how many people can take a clue from that? How many people can take a clue? My next step of research along this line, I don't think I'm going to try to do any more whale watching here in Eastern Australia. I'm going to concentrate on getting some artwork done and see if I can make it over to Uluru in the Central Desert in honor of this sacred song line in the next few weeks before I return to Great Barrier Island, New Zealand. But I need to do some research on the total amount of whale watching businesses that exist in Australia, in the world. I know that in Nelson Bay there's 3, in Harvey Bay there's 8. There's probably ones in every major port along the east and southern coast, probably have whale watching businesses. And I'm wondering if there's a central organization. This is something that I tried to get out of Brian yesterday, but I wasn't sure of the clarity of what he shared, of what level of bureaucratic organizations gives permits for whale watching. Is it the local council? Is it the state government? Is it the federal government? I do know that to get a whale watching license requires the one-time payment of hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then probably an annual renewal fee. But it's not just whale watching. But it'd be interesting to know how many whale watching businesses exist in Australia, how many exist in the whole world. It's so ironic and oxymoronic that a boat like the Imagine, which is a highly capable sailboat, never uses the sails. So, like I told my friend Douglas Webster in Hawaii a couple of years ago, I think that the only truly valid way to be close to whales is in a boat under your own power, whether it's wind, oars, or swimming, paddling, like a canoe, a kayak, a surfboard, swimming. This is the only way to approach whales truly invasively. You can go out and position yourself, let them come to you. I'm going to draw this show to a close here. I've just had my acoustic sphere invaded by 5 elderly people who each have a dog, and they're sitting there babbling about who knows what. But they don't look very concerned about anything that's happening in Australia, environmentally, spiritually, ecologically, geopolitically. It's just so weird how I seem to be in a different dimension from the people here in general. I notice all this stuff and I care about it, but it's invisible to people. Just like the indigenous people here are basically invisible to the white man. It's just really, really scary. I'd like to thank you for listening to the 118th broadcast of On the Brink Radio. Please send beautiful, healing love and energy to all the whales and dolphins, especially the little Maui's dolphin in New Zealand. There's only 50 of them left. There's only 12 breeding females. It's beyond sick that this is happening anywhere, but especially in a country like New Zealand that advertises that it's 100% clean and green. Beyond belief. Frank Future was shocked when I told him that last time I went out on his boat, we saw a very young baby humpback whale with its mother. And Frank speculated. I said, like, well, what do you reckon they're saying to each other? And he goes, he reckoned that the mom was saying, now, little baby, you better get used to these boats, because you're going to be seeing a lot of them. That's what Frank said, and I came back to him a couple of days ago, and I said, like, you know, I think what they were communicating was actually vastly different. I think it was more along the lines of, my dear child, I know you're distressed by the presence of these noisy contraptions with those insane beings, but don't worry. Their presence here is not going to be for much longer. And I really agree with that. It's not like that humans aren't already taking themselves out. But I really feel now more than ever, after witnessing firsthand so many blatant violations of just the true respect that if we were truly people, we would never inflict ourselves on our fellow beings in the way that we do, especially in the name of the false god of money. I really feel that my sense of urgency and warning from the whales and dolphins is evident, that a major planetary catastrophe or cataclysm of some kind totally unknown to us is coming a lot sooner than we think. And I don't pretend to know what it is. I don't pretend to know that this is really true, but it's a very powerful intuition that I feel. We've been given a chance to pull back on our destructive ways of living, but instead we've put the pedal to the metal. We've been warned by indigenous elders from all over the world for decades. I think we've had our chance as human beings, that now our, as a whole, our protoplasm could be much more healthfully deployed with other forms of life who are living on their true spiritual path. Now more than ever, I think that we need to heed what I consider to be the most fundamental message from the whales and dolphins. Live simply so that others may simply live. I'd really like to thank Frank Future and Brian Perry. I'd really like to thank Wally Franklin and Trish and Mark Francis for their wonderful contributions towards my work. And I've done an hour and a half long interview with Wally that I think might be my radio show next week. Anyway, thanks for tuning in to On the Brink Radio with Jeff Weverson. I'm signing out here from Harvey Bay, Queensland. Live simply so that others may simply live. Good day.